The House will now have under consideration House Bill 262. Gentleman from 5.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would request unanimous consent to dispense with the further reading of House Bill 262.
Without objection.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I also request unanimous consent to dispense with Rule 22 so I might refer to other legislation.
Without objection. The gentleman may refer to other legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 262 is the third bill before you that we've brought through the Education Committee to try to set some parameters so the Appropriations Committee tomorrow or Monday when they get to the K-12 budget will be able to set a lower number. I've mentioned this before, I believe yesterday with House Bill 256, but this is the third of three bills, 252 being the first of the three bills. The purpose of this legislation, Mr. Speaker and members, is to reduce the cost of the FY10 public school appropriation. And by passing this bill, it will minimize the amount that will have to be cut from teacher and other K-12 staff salaries. Provisions related to reducing costs include the institution of a one-year freeze in the vertical movement on the state salary reimbursement grid, which is related to years of experience. The vertical movement is related to years of experience on the grid. This will prevent automatic state funding for a 3.75% raise in FY10 for teachers and administrators currently moving through the grid. The bill also phases out the early retirement program. You might hear us refer to it today as ERIP, E-R-I-P, stands for Early Retirement Incentive Program for teachers. Administrators participated in this program in the past, but they were eliminated from this program in 2003. The legislation also encourages districts to accommodate reductions in state funding for salaries by either reducing the level of pay or reducing the number of paid contact days, and requires that any reduction in contact days does not result in a reduction of student-teacher contact time, which I think you've heard all of us talk about and feel that that's very important, maintaining student-teacher contact time. Mr. Speaker, the fiscal note on this proposed legislation would save the state an estimated $6.1 million on the grid movement in FY 2010, and the provision related to phasing out the early retirement program will save $2 million in FY10, and after that the early retirement incentive program would then be eliminated, saving the state approximately $4 million in FY11 and each year thereafter. In total, this bill will save the state general fund $8.1 million in FY10, which will equate to about a 1% savings or a 1% less reduction in teacher salaries, which is what we have been trying to do all along, minimize the cut to teacher salaries. But Mr. Speaker, members, I'd like to just briefly go over the bill. It's a short bill. But I would just start on page 1, there at the bottom, 33.521 is referenced, and you'll notice on line 30, 31, and 32, we've stricken some language. The purpose of striking that language is simply the cross-reference to 33.1004G, which is the part of Idaho Code that deals with the Early Retirement Incentive Program. If you open to page 2, flip open to page 2, there is where we get into 33.1004A, which is the experience and education multiplier in the grid I referred to in my opening statement. You'll see the new language is on lines, the end of line 24 and line 25, where we've inserted minus 1, provided, however, that the experience factor cannot be less than 0. And there is the language that will allow a one-year freezing of the grid, and that portion there will save the state just a little bit over $6 million. What's important here is by doing this, what we're trying to do is preserve programs and learning opportunities for the children. We talk about what we can do in public education to help the children of the state. I believe this bill is one of those examples. We are able to preserve the programs and the learning opportunities for the children that have direct positive results. If we would flip over to page 3, section 3, we get into 33.1004G, same title, same code section, just a different subsection, but it deals with the Early Retirement Incentive Program, ERIP, and if you drop down to line 21 and the first word on 22, we've inserted one half of, And basically, that's where we're cutting a $4 million appropriation we've spent in the last few years in this program to $2 million. And the savings I referenced earlier, there is a reference there to code section 33-1004E on line 23. I'd just like the body to know that 33-1004E deals with the school district salary-based apportionment. That's why it's mentioned in that section, everything else being the same. And I can give you an example, Mr. Speaker. Typically, there's about 200 to 230 teachers the last few years that have used this program, and the average payout has been in the neighborhood of $17,500, give or take a little bit. This legislation were to pass, those teachers that were planning on using the ERIP program this year, their payout would be cut in half. So an example of 200 or so on average getting 17.5, it would be then down to, what would that be, 18,000 or 8,750. And that's approximating it, Mr. Speaker, because sometimes we'll have 200 teachers and other years 230 teachers. What we've done in the past, Mr. Speaker, is we've trued this up at the end of the year. It's a funny system in that teachers put in for this retirement at the end of this school year, if this is the year they'd like to retire. But the appropriation, the incentive check is sent out in August once we've reached the new fiscal year. So it kind of, you retire in one fiscal year, but the payment comes in the next fiscal year. Mr. Speaker, we did, in 2003, this legislature dropped the administrators from this plan. The administrators used to be part of the ERIP plan, and in 2003, the administrators were dropped. And I can tell this body, it did not cost the state any more money. I think you'll hear the opposition speak to this portion, that this saves the state money, and we can sure get into that, Mr. Speaker, when we get into the debate. But I can tell the body this, that the only actual evidence we have that this plan either saves the state money or costs the state money is looking back at the last 5 years since we've dropped the administrators from this plan, and we have actual evidence that shows that by dropping the administrators from this plan, it has saved the state money. We feel that once this plan is eliminated, it will save the state in the neighborhood of the $4 million a year. Members of the body, if you just flip over to page 4, I would bring your attention to line 21 and 22. The stricken language there is just because, and I should back up, Mr. Speaker, line 14. Line 14 then goes into section 4, and it shows that 33-1004G Idaho Code B and the same is hereby repealed. So on page 3, I talked about the first year. We'll cut it in half in fiscal year 10 from a $4 million appropriation to a $2 million appropriation. And then after that, section 4 talks about that section of code being completely repealed. And now I'll go back down to lines 21 and 22. A purpose there is we just have to strike any cross reference to 33-1004G if the goal of this legislature and the will of this body is to support this legislation. And then I would bring the body's attention down to section 7 and the emergency existing therefore, which emergency is hereby declared to exist. Section 3 of this act shall be in full force and effect on and after passage and approval, and retroactively to March 1 of 2009. The reason for that language, members, is the applications to access this program are sent out by the State Department on March 1st, so we wanted to make sure that we were covering all our bases, and that's the purpose of the language, retroactively to March 1. Section 7 goes on to say, Sections 1, 4, and 5 of this Act shall be in full force in effect on or after January 1 of 2010, and Section 2 of this Act shall be in full force and effect on July 1 of 2009. So an emergency clause existing, but I wanted the members to see which emergency date dealt with each section. With that, Mr. Speaker, I would sure stand for any questions, and debate is open.
Is there further debate?
Mr. Speaker.
Gentleman from 7.
Point of order. I believe that that the two propositions contained in House Bill 262 are clearly divisible. Under Rule 15, I think we are best dividing the question, and therefore I move that House Bill 262 be returned to committee for division into separate questions.
Mr. Speaker, I second the motion.
You've heard the motion. This is a debatable motion.
Mr. Speaker, I object.
It was a motion. Would the good gentleman for seven care to open?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good ladies and gentlemen of the body, it is the clear intent of our rules under Rule 15 and the traditions that we uphold, but also the Idaho Constitution, Article 3, Section 16, which states, quote, every act shall embrace but one subject, close quote. Therefore, I ask that this bill be sent back to the Education Committee for division and allowing us then to have proper consideration. This bill, if enacted, has great potential to end up in court. Testimony to that was presented in committee. By freezing years of service, there's a real possibility of affecting the employee's retirement rights. I do not believe that we are wise to add additional exposure to the state by a claim of a constitutional violation. Mr. Speaker and ladies and gentlemen of the body, I think it would be best to divide these subjects and vote on them separately.
Is there further debate? Gentleman from five.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To debate against the motion. And Mr. Speaker, is Rule 22 still suspended that I might refer?
Without objection, the gentleman may refer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would remind this body of a bill that we spent some time on yesterday here, House Bill 256, which wasn't as closely connected as this bill. I would bring the body's attention to the sections of this bill. It deals with the same Title 33 in the same chapter. I mean, that's how closely connected this bill is. Both issues deal with teacher compensation. And one is 33-1004A, and one is 33-1004G. I just don't know how more closely connected you could get a piece of legislation that's in the same title, the same chapter, the same section. And I strongly speak against the motion. I think this bill stands just fine on its own as is, and I would hope that the members of this body would reject the motion.
Is there further debate? Lady from 24.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I too rise to oppose the motion. Is the suspension of Rule 22 still in order, Mr. Speaker?
Yes, it is.
It's not unusual to combine the number of budget reduction issues in the same bill. In House Bill 123, the Health and Welfare Committee and this body passed a budget reduction bill that reduced nursing home rates, reduced funding to hospitals, created a freeze on intermediate care facility rates, placed freezes on physicians and dentists' rates, and removed certain transportation funding, all in one bill, Mr. Speaker. And I ask for this body's no vote.
Is there further debate?
Mr. Speaker, a gentleman question 50. On point of order.
The gentleman has the floor.
Mr. Speaker, reviewing Rule 15, Rule 15 indicates that if a question is to be divided, each portion thereof shall be voted on separately, the same as if it had been offered alone. And as I read that, that doesn't mean it goes back to the committee to be divided into a bill, but it requires that it be voted on separately in this body. And I'm just asking for a clarification.
Well, good gentlemen, if you'll read further in Rule 15, it says, but no bill, resolution, memorial, or Senate amendment to any House bill or proposition shall be divisible. And I think what that says to me that the motion is proper to send it back to committee because the bill cannot be divided on the floor.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you.
So further Speaker, debate. Gentleman from 8.
Mr. Speaker, I want to remind the body that the bill on the second line of the first page in the title of the bill, the title states relating to education, and then as you move down through the bill in each section, all sections are from Title 33 of the Idaho Code, all in relationship to education. Mr. Speaker, I would am debating against the move to divide the bill.
Is there further debate? Gentleman from 16.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Debate in favor of the motion. One of my concerns with House Bill 262, in addition to the fact that it's very likely to end up in court, and we don't want to pass legislation simply to have it returned to us on a technicality, has to do with the fiscal note. I think, as we know, under Joint Rule 18, there is a requirement for a fiscal note. We've got two distinct issues with potentially, and I think in reality, two different fiscal impacts. And I would say that under the retirement portion of the bill, there was testimony, I understand, in committee to the effect that the retirement program actually saves the state of Idaho money, and to the extent that that testimony was accurate, I think the fiscal note is inaccurate in how it relates to the repeal of the retirement program. If we are saving money because of the retirement program...
Mr. Speaker, I object. I thought we were debating the motion, not the bill here.
I'll give the gentleman the latitude, but please do debate the motion whether or not this should be returned to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If we repeal the early retirement program, and if the early retirement program is saving us money, then the impact, the general fund impact, will be negative, not positive. And for that reason, I think it's important, in addition to the potential constitutional issue, to return this bill to committee. Thank you.
Is there further debate? Hearing none, would the good gentleman from 7 care to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think it's clear that many of us have concerns about the potential legal liability, and I believe that returning this bill to committee to divide it into to bills that could be considered properly will allow us the best protection and save us the most legal cost money, and therefore I ask for a yes vote on the motion. Thank you.
Debate is closed. Question is, shall House Bill 262 be returned to the Education Committee to be divided?
Roll call vote, Mr. Speaker.
A roll call has been requested. Three must rise. The clerk will unlock the machine. The members will record their votes. It's open.
Still not.
Should we pick a call? The clerk shall call the roll.
Okay, I don't know. Sorry for that happening. Anderson? Andrus?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Bayer?
No.
Bedke?
No.
Bell?
No.
Bilbao?
No.
Black?
No.
Block?
No.
Bo?
Yes.
Bowles?
No.
Boyle?
No.
Burgoyne?
Yes.
Chatterton?
No.
Chavez?
Yes.
Chu?
Yes.
Clark?
No.
Collins?
No.
Crane?
No.
Cronin?
Yes.
Denny?
No.
Durst?
Aye.
Eskridge?
No.
Gibbs?
No.
Hagedorn?
No.
Hart? Hart?
No.
Hartgen?
No.
Harwood?
No.
Henderson?
No.
Higgins?
Yes.
Jaquit?
Yes.
Jarvis?
No.
Killen?
Aye.
King?
Yes.
Kryn?
No.
Labrador?
No.
Legg?
No.
Lurcher?
No.
Luker?
Nay.
Marriott?
No.
Matthews?
No.
McGeehan?
No.
Moyle?
No.
Nielsen?
No.
Nonini?
No.
Palmer?
No.
Paisley Stewart?
Yes.
Patrick? Patrick?
No.
Pence?
Yes.
Raybould?
No.
Ringo?
Yes.
Roberts?
No.
Ruckty?
Yes.
Rushi?
Yes.
Saylor?
Yes.
Schaefer?
No.
Shepherd 2? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Yes. Shepherd 8?
No.
Shirley? Simpson?
No.
Smith? Smith 30?
Yes.
Smith 24?
No.
Stevenson?
No.
Takasugi?
No.
Thane?
No.
Thompson?
No.
Trail?
No.
Wills?
No.
Wood 27?
No.
Wood 35?
No.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. No, and so one absent. That makes 19. So that's okay. 29I. I'm gonna add.
Other way around, right?
Oh, sorry.
Roll call shows 18 I, 49 Nay, 1 absent and excused. Less than a majority having voted in the affirmative, the motion has failed. The House will. Gentleman from 7.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In light of my success last time, I move that we refer House Bill 262 to general orders that the potentially problematic areas might be removed.
Mr. Speaker, I second the motion.
This is a debatable motion. Gentleman from 7 to open debate.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll be real short. We talked about this last time. I think there's still a great potential to end up in court, and I think there is a possible way that we can improve the bill and not make the state's position more perilous.
So further debate. Gentleman from 18.
Mr. Speaker, pursuant to rule, joint rule 18, if I could read, please. Mr. Speaker, Rule 22 has already been suspended, so I didn't really have to ask. But let me read verbatim. No bill making an appropriation increasing or decreasing existing appropriations or requiring a future appropriation or increasing or decreasing revenues of the state or any unit of local government or requiring a significant expenditure of funds by the state or a unit of local government shall be introduced unless it shall have attached thereto a fiscal note. The note shall contain an estimate of the amount of such appropriations, expenditures, or changed under the bill. The fiscal note shall identify a full fiscal year's impact of the legislation. Here's the point. This bill isn't revenue neutral, and it will impact districts on a district-by-district basis adversely, and therefore I would object under Joint Rule 18 that this fiscal note is inappropriately placed and should be revised, therefore supporting the motion to general orders.
Gentleman for 5.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To speak against the motion to send this bill to general orders, and specifically the good gentleman from 18's comment on the fiscal note, I don't think this fiscal note could be any more accurate. We know that by 1 year freezing of the grid, we saved the state $6.1 million. And by cutting the ERIP program in half from $4 million to $2 million in FY10, we know there's an exact savings of $2 million. I think this fiscal note of if this legislation were to pass, it will save the state $8.1 million a year. Again, I see no reason to send the bill to general orders. I think this bill stands on its own, and I believe the fiscal note is quite accurate. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
So further debate. Gentleman, 17.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In support of the point raised by the good gentleman from 18, we have a situation here where we're going to be reducing, if the bill passes, general fund appropriations. In fact, that's the whole point of the bill, as stated in the statement of purpose. On the other hand, we have existing districts, in fact, I suspect virtually the vast majority, that have presently contract commitments that extend over straddle the period that this bill affects. Those commitments require them to meet salary obligations within their districts. This appropriation reduction is going to require them, in order to legally meet those obligations, to shift their funding from what they anticipated to receive from the state to the local property taxpayers. That is a consequence on those local units of government. It is not reflected in the fiscal note. Therefore, it should be returned on general orders.
Is there further debate? Hearing none, would the good gentleman from 7 care to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Again, I have serious concerns about the bill and the ability to protect the state's position, and ask that we be given an opportunity in general orders to improve that. Thank you.
Debate is closed. Question is, shall House Bill 262 be placed on general orders? Clerk will unlock the machine and the members will record their votes. Has every member recorded their vote?
Andrus.
Representative Andrus, how do you vote?
No.
Representative Andrus votes no. Does any member wish to change their vote? The clerk will lock the machine and record the roll. Roll call shows 18 aye, 51 nay. One absent and excused, less than a majority having voted in the affirmative, the motion has failed. The House has under consideration House Bill 262. Is there further debate? Gentleman from 7.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You might guess that I don't like this bill very much. Mr. Speaker, this bill, and ladies and gentlemen of the House, this bill is unnecessary. We made it unnecessary by passing House Bill 252. These changes in this bill were considered and in a process and by participants in the collaborative project and were rejected as not needed. This was a process that openly considered them and included the school boards, the district superintendents, parent teachers associations, the education association, representatives of the state superintendent's office, as well as members of this body. These changes were considered by that group and were discarded. They add more complications to an already difficult situation. I ask why, when those that actually work in schools and school administration discarded these, do we then see them back before us? Changing the law on years of service might decrease Percy benefits for these loyal workers. It looks like we're not going to be cutting not only their pay if the proposed budgets for education are adopted, but also maybe changing their retirement. what are we trying to accomplish? It's not necessary to poke the teachers in the eye. We established that when we were developing House 252, we developed a process to allow the local school districts to deal with the financial issues with their associations. Mr. Speaker, this is unneeded and a divisive bill. It's wrong for Idaho schools and the kids and the families they serve. Please vote no.
So further debate. Gentleman from 16.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to ask permission to read one sentence from an Idaho Supreme Court opinion in my debate and one sentence from a 1996 Attorney General opinion in my debate.
Without objection, the gentleman may read.
Thank you. Well, I suppose it's obvious I'm not crazy about this bill either. But what I want to focus on in my debate are what I view as some technical defects and the likelihood of litigation arising out of this bill and that the likelihood that the state will lose this litigation. First of all, Section 2 of the bill, having to do with experience steps, on page 2, lines 24 and 25, the operative language, it appears to me, is minus 1. What this relates to is the experience and education ladder, setting out years, degrees, and experience for school teachers and factors that are used to calculate pay across this ladder. Now, my reading of the bill is that the minus one that the bill attempts to accomplish is to take the one away from the ladder, which under each of the columns from left to right read BA, BA plus 12, BA plus 24, BA plus 36, MA, etc., thereby reducing each of the factors shown there to a decimal. Take in the case of a BA with 2 years, it would be 0.03750. But it is my understanding that the intent of this legislation is to take one away from the years column. If that is the intent, I cannot discern it from the actual language used here. And so I think that the bill, in order to be effective, would have to be much more clear as to what the minus one pertains to. Section 2 of the bill substantively concerns me because there are no provisions for catch-up in the bill when the financial situation that we are in is over. So the consequences of losing a year on the ladder will follow a teacher through his or her career forever and into retirement and will impact Percy benefits. That, in my estimation, denies the teacher certain vested rights under Percy, and I'd like to transition now to discuss the early retirement part of this bill, which I think also, under the law, is a vested right for teachers, current teachers, and the fact that this bill can only lawfully affect new teachers who are hired, not teachers who are already in the system. And in that regard, the Idaho Supreme Court, in the case of Nash versus Boise City Fire Department, a 1983 Supreme Court case, said that changes in a pension plan which results in disadvantage to employees should be accompanied by comparable new advantages. In this public employee's retirement case, the court essentially said, yes, you can adjust pension benefits, but when you do, because of the vesting requirement, you have to accompany those changes with comparable new advantages. This bill does not provide any comparable new advantages. In my view, what the court is saying is that when a right is vested, you can adjust the pension benefit to keep the system solvent. But what you can't do is just take away the benefit. So when you delete something from the retirement benefit in one place to keep it solvent, you have to put something back in another place to keep the employee whole. Finally, I'd like to note an Attorney General's opinion, a 1996 opinion, it's number 5, wherein the Attorney General, in discussing retirement, said, "We recognize that there is a difference between the ability to prospectively reduce the rate at which an employee earns retirement benefits and the elimination of any rights of earned future retirement benefits." And again, I think there the lesson is clear. You can take for people who are not employed as of the effective date of this law and become employed after that effective date, and you can adjust or eliminate retirement benefits. But what you cannot do is take current employees who are under current contracts and reduce their retirement benefits because they are vested. One further point, I want to be as open with this body as I can be. There is a suggestion in some of what I've read that the point at which the employee might have these vested benefits in retirement that they cannot take away might not come for a period of 10 years. So that it might be that new employees up to 10-year employees could be affected in ways that employees over 10 years cannot be. Well, many of our teachers are over 10 years, and under what I have seen, it appears to me they have a vested right, and the state is opening itself up to lawsuits and claims with this legislation. The last and final point I wish to make is about the retroactivity clause. March 1, 2009. For any contracts currently in effect, I think that retroactivity clause, or any contracts that may have been signed between March 1 and now, and there may not be any, I don't know, but I think that would create a problem. Thank you.
So further debate.
Mr. Speaker.
Lady from 32.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In favor of the bill, I seems like a lot of the discussion right now that's going on is the legal implications and the threat of lawsuits. And I can tell you that we're struggling with the same legal implications across the board with our state employees and how to deal with higher education budgets in the same area. In fact, we had a meeting in JFAC late afternoon yesterday to discuss the issue of the legality and the legal aspects of what we need to do. It seems to me, however, that what trumps all of this argument is our constitutional mandate to balance our state budget. And nobody likes to be where we're at right now. Nobody wants to have to make these decisions that we're being asked to make. And I think it's really unfair to be making comments like we're poking teachers in the eye. Nobody wants to be here making these decisions, but we do have a constitutional mandate to balance our state budget. And if you take a look, some might make the argument that we're not using enough of our stabilization funds in fiscal year 2010. But this is also a scenario that we're faced with in Idaho with the one-time implication of these funds, that normally when we normally only look at the next fiscal year and what we make our decisions based on from year to year. But because of the huge, huge loss of tax revenues in our state and the limited time to be able to use this stabilization funding, we're being forced to look 2 to 3 years into the future, which we don't normally do. And our budget committee and also the Economic Outlook Revenue Committee has done that. They have done a forecast into the future years, and I'd be happy to show that to anyone who's interested, to show how we're going to run through all of those stabilization accounts. And we've got to be really conservative and cautious, because if we're not, we're going to find ourselves at the end of 2 years in a much worse financial situation than where we are now. And if you think the decisions that we're going to be asked to make this year are going to be hard, then let's not be fiscally responsible and have to make some really, really tough decisions when we target our budget's too high and our economy doesn't come back and we have a much bigger gap in our revenue and expenditure picture than what we do now. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker?
Gentlemen.
A point of personal privilege.
Gentlemen, I have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, I must reluctantly declare Rule 38, and I say reluctantly because I would like my wife to keep working and make those big dollars that she's earning as a teacher. However, she is retiring early. She is getting a payout. I don't know what it is because she won't tell me. So I am declaring Rule 38, and I will be voting. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Gentleman from 29.
Mr. Speaker, just in response to the comments about the rainy day funds, I mean, what we know about our economy is that the free market is working hard to get back on track. We know that we are making efforts at the federal and the state level to get back on track. We also know that economists all over the nation, all over the world, frankly, are having a tough time figuring out when this economic downturn is going to end. So I say that because it does not make sense to take all of these cuts in state agencies and in education up front rather than trying to be more progressive about the approach that we're taking. We should certainly save some of the rainy day funds to make sure that we can get through our budget crisis that we expect to have in years 2 and 3, but to keep almost $400 million worth of rainy day funds untouched at a time when we're contemplating laying off workers, cutting programs, doesn't make sense financially. It is, frankly, why the rainy day funds were set up in the first place, to make sure that we could stabilize our budgets. It's a smart approach to use some of those rainy day funds now. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Lady from 35.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I do support the legislation with just one comment, that this threat of litigation that's been thrown out by the opposing debate several times appears to me to be an effort to intimidate, and that's okay. Anything we can do to get what we want. But we don't pass people, we don't pass anything in this body that is court-proof. It just depends on who you make mad, how much money they have, or how much they hope to get. So we need to get on with this. And anyway, that's why we have an attorney general. Thank you.
Lady from 7.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to debate against the bill. Good ladies and gentlemen of the House, you aren't going to be surprised that I am not in favor of this bill, as I am one of the collaborators on House Bill 252. But yesterday, as I listened to those that were speaking out in support of the work of CAMP, the Comprehensive Aquifer Management Plan Advisory Council in our Resources Committee, it occurred to me that it was very similar to the work that was done on House Bill 252. Stakeholders who might have in the past been ready to go to battle to defend their method of water usage have agreed to work together on a water plan because it's good for our whole state. The difference between that legislation and House Bill 252 is that the CAMP plan is being given a chance to mature and to work, and House Bill 252 hasn't been given that opportunity. Water is one of Idaho's most valued resources, but I would submit to you that education is just as precious a resource, and that without Idaho's dedicated teachers, education in Idaho would and could possibly dry up into an arid wasteland. House Bill 252 will work, making House Bill 262 unnecessary. But I fear it will not be given the time, nor will the local school districts, and so teachers' pay will be frozen statewide, whether it's good for local school districts or not. I have personally experienced a salary freeze, which had a fairly significant impact on my retirement. So I don't mind sharing that my monthly retirement check after teaching for 30 years is $1,100. House Bill 252 mitigates that reduction in salary during a catastrophic financial emergency, but on a temporary basis. My other concern in House Bill 262 is the elimination of the Early Retirement Investment Program, which allows teachers who have fulfilled the requirements to retire before the rule of 90, which is the combination of a teacher's age and years of teaching. This allows the district to hire a teacher who is at the beginning of their career, not necessarily a first-year teacher, but less expensive than the veteran teacher who is retiring. We live in a beautiful state, and many young people see this as a great place to live, recreate, and raise a family. But the elimination of the early retirement plan will keep many veteran teachers in the classroom, possibly past their best years, with fewer and fewer openings for teachers at the beginning of their careers. Just as in farming, turning over the soil, adding nutrients and water will improve a crop yield. The same principle can be applied to the early retirement investment program with a savings over time. I fear that should House Bill 262 pass, school districts will find it harder and harder to recruit and retain quality teachers, putting at risk our children's preparedness for post-secondary education or the world of work, and our children, Idaho's children, deserve better. Thank you.
Is there further debate? Lady from six.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I also rise to debate against the bill. I would like to begin by discussing the portion of it that refers to the salary grid. I did hand out copies of the current salary grid, which I'm sure everybody is familiar with, but just a little review may not hurt. So we know that every position on the grid has a multiplier, and that number times the base salary determines what the state will reimburse each district for the teacher in that particular position. Then we also know that we have in law the stipulation that no teacher shall receive less than $31,750, which requires that actually every position that you see I have fenced in there would be getting $31,750. Now, this does indicate what the state reimbursement to districts will be for their teachers. Many districts, however, have a grid that parallels this, and I would think quite likely then that many districts would simply say, well, since we're being reimbursed by freezing the experience, that's the way we'll go ahead and pay. And one thing that you might notice is that that's not going to affect all teachers equally. Many of the people inside the fence there will not expect an increment, because they will continue to get the $31,750. Also, people at the bottom of the grid wouldn't expect to get an increment. So the people most affected will be those who are actually expecting to have an experience move that will give them an increment. And I think that if districts would parallel what we're suggesting here, we would see that it would lead to unequal treatment. And let me just say in that regard that if we want to reduce the reimbursement that districts are getting by a certain percent, say 5%, all we have to do is go in the Joint Finance Committee and reduce the base pay by that percent. And then we'd have to reduce the $31,750 by that amount as well. So a very simple maneuver would allow us to accomplish this. So I don't think that we're necessarily arguing that some salary savings may not be necessary. It's just that this bill does not propose the best and most fair way of doing it. And I think that's one basis for rejecting. I'd like to get into the early retirement more, but I think having these two issues might make you tired of listening to me, but if that's possible. But let me just comment. that using the administrators as an example is probably not a very fair comparison. For one thing, there aren't nearly as many of them to take care of this, to take advantage of this program as you might see on the reverse side. So for that reason, you probably wouldn't see the salary savings. But the other thing is, or the savings resulting from the program, but the other thing is, most administrators that you hire are going to probably be higher, even if they're new, they'll be higher on the experience level, but more importantly, they're going to have more education, because the administrators have to have, I believe, at least a master's degree in order to have that credential which allows them to be an administrator. So they're going to be, there's not going to be the natural gap that you would expect as you would when an experienced teacher retires and a new one is hired. So I don't think that we can use that particular thing to anticipate whether or not there would be savings realized from the early retirement program, and indeed we can argue very convincingly that there would have to be. So I will stop there for now, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
Is there further debate? Lady from 25.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to debate for or against the bill. I have to think for a minute on that one. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, on this floor Tuesday, you heard me praising House Bill 252, which was designed to be an overarching bill to deal with education issues such as the salary schedule portion of this bill. Local school boards and their education leaders were elected by their peers to make decisions on how their schools are run, including how to apportion raises and cut them in time of crisis. Did all those involved in House Bill 252 waste the 4 weeks we spent? It certainly appears that way. Why is the salary grid even in this bill when, as the good lady that sits next to me just explained, when JFAC could easily set the multiplier by the intent process? They don't need this portion of the bill in order to do their work. What's going on? Is there a trust problem here? And who are we failing to trust? And I'll just leave it there and address the second issue within this bill. Early retirement, whether you love it or hate it, was implemented as an incentive for teachers nearing the end of their career. When they were at the top earning levels of the salary scale to allow them to retire. Schools, like any business that has a high human resource demand, the workforce seems to be in these particular high resource demand areas. For a lack of a better word, the workforce seems to be clumped. For a period of years, you may not be adding new employees, and then all of a sudden there are retirements, people moving, deaths, or whatever, and you hire a whole series of new people in a relatively short period of time. This clump traditionally has moved through our education system as a block. Well, as the schools were in a series of clump years and had at the high end, many of the people at the high end of the salary schedule, but they weren't eligible to retire because of this rule of 90. Early retirement was induced because of that higher salary was replaced with either beginning or quite often lower, and very often lower, much lower savings salaries. Within several years, a substantial savings is realized to the state. You will hear about the amount of, you already have heard about the amount of savings, and that it's really subject to a series of assumptions. That is true. The $95 million savings over the life of the program offered by one of the group's analysts is much higher than the one projected by analysts from an opposing group. I suggest it is likely to be somewhere in between those two figures. But there will be a savings. You can pick your number. What is factual is that it has been successful in opening up positions for new teachers in a district. And I think that was an integral part of this early retirement plan. This is a small savings. It's being realized at the expense of a much higher future savings. I ask you to weigh the value of these two concepts when you are considering your vote. Are we making good decisions here? I'm voting no because I think we're not.
Is there further debate? Gentleman from 27.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There's a couple of points that I think need to be made here in this debate. As a veteran of these, of the 2003 battles, or whatever you want to call them, that we had when we went to this same section of code, this 33-10-04-A, and that year, as you recall, Mr. Speaker, we were our goal that year was just to send out the same amount per support unit or per classroom that year as we had done the year before. The times were not as the economy was not as bad then as it is now. We had a significant downturn, but we were able, what we thought at the time, that if we just send out the same amount of money this year per classroom as we did the previous year. And we employed some of the tactics that the good lady from Moscow referenced in her debate, and were roundly criticized at that point for doing these types of changes, saying, notwithstanding whatever this section says, you know, this is how JFAC chooses to do that. It was thought that this year, as these, and I don't, and it, you know, and it, just a little side note, I don't know how we expected to send out with 85% of the money that is spent in public schools being going into salaries, and you know, members, you all need to sit down and read this title in chapter 10 and find out how we do fund schools. But if we thought that we could send out less money for salaries, whether it was administrative or teachers' salaries, without going into this code, either in the Appropriations Committee or in the Germain House Committee, and changing the language. Now, there's several ways you could have do it. You could have dropped the base, as the good lady referenced, that has its pros and cons. You can go in and say, we're going to pay lateral movement so that, but not downward movement in this grid, which is what this legislation does. But to think that you can't go into the part of the code where that governs how we send money out to the school districts and not change something there, regardless of House Bill 252, I think is naive, and it shows that you know, this is the main funding mechanism here, and it has to be changed. It has to be set aside, or it has to modified in some manner. This seems to be as unobtrusive a way as I can think of, but it's six one way, half a dozen the other. Let's keep in mind that none of us are enjoying this process. It is the economy. It's not mean-spiritedness or all the things that you will read in the press and that are forcing our hand here. It's the economy. We've had a major downturn, and the revenue is not available. And you know, these pieces of legislation, the one that we dealt with yesterday and this one that we're dealing with today, were all embedded in the pro forma budgets that the Appropriation Committee has struggled with for now 2.5 months. And they needed, sure, JFAC, or specifically the House Appropriations Committee, could have said, you know, in a chapter of intent language, could have said, notwithstanding the provisions in this title, notwithstanding the provisions in that title, this is what we're going to do. It was thought, and I agree with this, that having these statutory changes come through the Education Committee would be a preferred alternative. Obviously, you can't keep everybody happy ever. So I'm, but it's the economy. It is not. It's nothing else other than the economy. This part of the code has got to be set aside in some way or changed in some way. This is the way the state sends the money to the school districts. And everybody ought to brush up on that chapter, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
So further debate? Gentleman from 21.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, ladies and gentlemen, just briefly, I'd like to express my appreciation for the comments just now from the good gentleman from 27. This is an exceedingly challenging budget year. There are a lot of things that we have had to do in the budget proceedings in regards to the rest of state government, which have been very difficult decisions, but also, along with the good gentleman from 27, having invested so much time in the Economic Outlook Committee and realizing the situation we're in and the volatility. We're dealing with unprecedented lack of predictability in the whole revenue stream, and that lends some very tough, lends itself to some very tough decisions in the budget setting process. And if you look at the rest of state government, what we're doing here is, it is a very fair comparison in my mind. And nobody has worked, I won't say nobody's worked harder, but at least equal to my historical efforts and the good gentleman from 27 regarding things like minimum teacher pay and how we address those dollars best as we can to facilitate education. The grid, quite frankly, we had a rather significant debate last year in JFAC and the budget setting process about the grid, about many aspects of it that are flawed, and we hit a snag, but it opened up, it facilitated a lot of debate, and some things came from that dialogue last year that were very good, some critical aspects of the grid that were far from done addressing. But in this budget year, we have to do these things to make the whole budget ship fit, if you will. And in regards to the comments made on reserve funds, Mr. Speaker, be that our own historical fiscal prudence in Idaho and the fortune of having PSIF and the fortune of having other stabilization funds for the rest of state government, we also have this $165 million federal stimulus infusion for K through 12. We've already used $85 million of that in 09 to displace dollars from PSIF. PSIF is really intended for your unforeseen budget changes within the fiscal year, less for actually setting a budget, more for changes between budgets. We're very fortunate to have that buffer, and 09 proved that in spades. We will have to deal with all likelihood, with the volatility and the changes in the revenue stream, we'll likely have to be dipping into PSIF significantly, despite our best efforts in the budget setting process in FY10. The feds also allowed the flexibility to apply that $165 million over 3 years. They know that we have to meet our needs as an individual state. We're not all made the same, and we've already done that in 09. We're going to use some of that money in 10. As far as I subscribe to, I'd like to have some of that money from the $165 million stimulus dollars available in FY11. So, this is a harsh reality, but we have a responsibility. We have to look at this in all fairness. We're forced in the budget arena to draw comparisons and try to handle the appropriations across the board as fairly as we can. There is a lot of local control. There are discretionary dollars in other places. We don't micromanage that, but we have to set the budget, and it has to be balanced. And we have to have those reserves because of the changes that have historically recently been there and will continue to be there through all economic expectation in FY10. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I would urge your support of this proposal.
Lady from 30.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As a fourth generation native Idahoan, and I'm proud to say my grandchildren are the sixth generation to be born in Idaho, I look at House Bill 262 as unprecedented in Idaho history for cutting public education. This morning was our weekly Chamber of Commerce legislative phone call with the Greater Pocatello Chamber of Commerce when they inform us of the positions they have taken. one bill that they are opposing, which they took a vote, was to oppose House Bill 262. So I thought about it, and then I later called them back saying, why did you oppose 262? Because the Chamber of Commerce is known as a pretty conservative group. Well, they informed me that this was unanimous on this vote, and they opposed it because they felt 262 was bad faith bargaining to bring a separate bill because of the agreement on House Bill 252. And so the Chamber of Commerce in Pocatello and I urge your no vote. Thank you.
Go ahead,
Mr. Speaker.
Gentleman 14.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House do now recess until the hour of 1:30.
Been moved and seconded that the House recess until the hour of 1:30. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed nay.
Nay.
The motion is carried and the House stands recessed until 1:30 p.m.